I want you to get mad.
Always Record, episode 122. Today's Always Record is a continuation of a conversation that began on 42 Minutes, episode 188, hosted by Douglas Bowles and Will Morgan, with a roundtable consisting of Jason Horsley, Andras Jones, Bill Klaus, David Plate, and Patrick Savek. Since Always Record is the second part of this crossover special with 42 Minutes, you'll likely want to listen to that first. Or hey, if you're into the whole non-linear thing, listen in any order you like.
All I know is that first, you've got to get mad!
Thank you guys, that was fun.
Yeah, once again, how fucking short these shows are. I'm sorry guys, I'm talking so much. It's really like 42 minutes. I mean,
yeah, why do you talk so fucking much?
I know, dude, I'm sorry. I can't help it. But you know what, though? It's going to be closer to 42 minutes.
Because oh my gosh, David, the GOAT comment the other day on Always Record with Jason Ferreira cracked me up.
What GOAT comment?
You're like, that is not how it happened. The GOAT got on him.
All right, gentlemen, it has been a pleasure. I'm out. Please continue and have a wonderful
not
day.
Not always recording? What?
We're yeah, we work. Are. Will's got to go to work.
Oh, I'm leaving.
Look,
man.
That, Will Morgan. You're calling him sick.
You're calling him sick today.
What
dude,
would Don Draper do?
Don Draper would go to work.
No, he would disappear for a few days.
He'd show up when he wants to.
He would take a nap on his couch with some bourbon.
All right.
Champions.
Hey, wait, Will, watch for the horse themes in the show.
Watch for the horse. Well, the horse, the whole thing with her and riding horses is pretty prevalent. And yeah, there's horses like in the backgrounds and stuff. But to me, so horses kind of symbolize sexual morality. So there's this whole thing and what she's dealing with as far as like the promiscuity of her husband. And she doesn't even know. Like, it's so weird because she has no idea who he is. She's totally clueless. And like what he says that to Peggy Olson at one time. He's like, you will be shocked at how much it didn't happen. And he basically molds Peggy to be a smaller version of him. That's why it's cool that her name is, you know, Peggy Olson, like Johnny Olson or Jimmy Olson from Superman comic books. It's like there's this whole thing going on there where she's molded from day one to think like Draper. And then there's the period where she actually that same episode actually where she becomes Draper's equal in a way. And then she slowly moved up the ranks once Freddy's gone. And she even has a kid with, you know, Draper's arch nemesis, Peter Campbell, right off the bat, the first fucking season. It's crazy.
Right, right.
But I'm out, gentlemen.
But then, okay, so yeah, you just opened a can of worms. It's great.
Peace.
Jason was talking about the idea of the mother. And Peggy Olson is this mother on some level because she has a child that she doesn't keep.
Oh, dude, totally. I felt like one of the most important lines in the entire show, at least for me, and this probably might sound weird to you guys, is when there's the discussion about bringing the kid to go see Planet of the Apes, and the mother's upset. And I'm sorry, it's been too long. I always forget this guy's name. Pierce?
What's Roger. The fucking,
Roger what? I'm just
Sterling.
Yeah, Roger Sterling. Okay, so Roger Sterling says, oh, well, my mom brought me to go see the Golem when I was a kid. And, like, I mean, Patrick, I'm sure you can appreciate this, and I don't know. You guys know me. What the fuck? I'm watching this movie, and I'm already tripping out over the whole Moonchild Golem thing and relating it to Rosemary's Baby for days, and just I'm seeing all this stuff. I mean, I you watch an episode, it's so long. I mean, I don't have enough notes here to show all the places where I was tripping out on that. But then that was like the direct sync wink for me. I was like, oh, really? Because I relate to the whole 60s as creating a golem. Like, I don't look at a golem as embodied necessarily. I see that spreading the philosophy of Thelema and all of that, and I connect it to the nuclear bomb, and I have this whole trip out on it. It's in my sync book chapter. But, like, I was looking for that. I guess you could argue that if you're looking for something, that, you know, whatever, but of all the things that he could say, because the people who did the Golem did Metropolis, and Metropolis is about this Scarlet Woman, and it's got this whole, and about Babel, and that's the theme of the whole fucking deal. And like right before, in the 1920s, before Metropolis came out, these people produced the Golem, and it's all the whole special effects crew and all of that. Did you know that? I mean, I don't.
So, but actually, this is a question that I have that I'm really curious about Madman, and sort of goes to what you were just saying about if you're looking for it. I'm curious, are there things that you expected to happen or see based at, like, so we've been having all these sync theories about this since, you know, probably season 2 or 3. We've been having we've been hovering around this conversation. I know I've almost had it with you, Dave, several times, and David, and I think Bill as well. And like with all of you, we've had these conversations about Mad Men and what the sinks are that are going on there. And I know that there are some things that I thought would show up that didn't, which in a way I always think of as kind of a good sink test. Like if everything you expect to see shows up, you're looking in a mirror. You're not, there's no way that you're connected to the, unless you have a total psychic connection with the artist and you're completely on the same wavelength. So I'm just kind of curious, were there things you expected him to explore or go to that he didn't?
I thought that Don would have an explicit psychedelic experience, chemical wise, endemic to the culture and the time. Clearly, yeah. He goes on a trip, and he goes on his own odyssey. So, I mean, it's represented, but I thought it would be explicit. He tokes a few reefers every now and then, but it doesn't really seem to affect him too radically. So that's why I think he never makes the jump to any harder stuff, because he kind of knows what that is. So I like that curveball. Like, I'm glad that didn't happen. If it would have happened, I think I wouldn't have liked the show. So.
Well, Roger was the one who got to do that. We get
our fix. We get to see it, but it's in a way that we didn't expect.
Yeah, I agree. I love that.
Because Sterling kind of stays the same. He rolls with the punches on that shit. I mean, he goes as out there as you can, but he doesn't really get swallowed up by the experience. He just sort of puts it on the shelf and says, oh, I can use that whenever I need to. And
well, he goes right back into the pattern. I mean, that's the thing. He has this huge break from the pattern, all these realizations and everything. And then it's like, despite all of his revelations or whatever, that's such an expansive experience. It's true to what often happens, where you just go right back into the old swing of things with a little something extra in there for Daddy simultaneously.
My one last thing about the LSD thing is a friend of mine pointed this out, and I think it was a really astute observation. Sterling, when they get sold to McCann Erickson, they mistake Peggy for a secretary, and she's staying in the abandoned building while everyone moves over to McCann Erickson, right? So there's a sort of girl falling in this wasteland, right? And there's a scene where Sterling is there, and he's looking for booze, right?
Oh, yeah. Will you drink vermouth?
Will you drink vermouth, right? And I think that Sterling is looking for any way to slip her some of the LSD he has, because he realizes she's a little girl in a big man's world, and she needs to see some shit. So it's a father-daughter. It's like, I'm going to share my wisdom with you. And so she stays with her. He's a sitter. He stays with her the whole time, and she just roller skates around that room. And then the next shot you see is her in the sunglasses entering McCann Erickson like a badass, because she figured out exactly what she was going into. So that wasn't explicit, but I think that's 100% accurate in that it's a father-daughter passing the torch of wisdom, and he dosed her. I think it's a beautiful...
You think he dosed her? Well, I did not catch that. Thank you, Bill.
Interesting. See, that's so funny, because I totally get that. And at the same time, I think that the initiation is different. It's more like she used to be intimidated by this guy, and he's kind of pathetic and lonely. I mean, that line, I've been thinking about that line, would you drink vermouth? Because as a bartender, that's just hilarious. That's some pitiful alcoholic behavior. Mm-hmm. And so she's there, and she is clearly She's not just his equal. She's the future, and he is not. And so I get the father-daughter thing, but it felt much more like that moment when you see your father not as this, you know, terrifying, perfect, you know, being, Superman, but you see him as an old drunk who's lonely and just wants, you know, and has no one to talk to. And you're
not
the future.
Not to badger it, but just one little mathematical point. If all they had was a bottle of vermouth, there's no way she would have gotten that drunk to be in that kind of state where she's roller skating blissfully off on another planet. So just mathematically, they didn't have enough alcohol for her to get that whacked out. There was something, I think, in her cup.
So I'll give you that metaphorically that's the case, but, you know.
It's really tasty if you allow yourself to really go with it, but yeah, it might be.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
So does Dawn explicitly create that Coke ad? That's explicitly what happens.
I think that's what... I mean, there's... if.
I thought Peggy did that first.
Well, I thought that it would be really interesting. I think what the show that I'd love to see them do right now is just, like, the making of the Coke ad. Do it as a movie. The making of that Coke ad where Joan is running the... video is running the production company that does it.
It's actually pretty good, man.
And they bring in everyone to, like, that would be so fucking awesome, right? We're just so hungry for it, but I don't think they'll give it to us, but it would be amazing. Because they could all have their roles in it. Let's talk about some of these other characters who are, like, we're focusing a lot on the main guys and the main women, but there are all these really interesting other characters, like Lane, the suicidal Englishman. Or who's the one who's the author who gets shot in the face?
Ken Cosgrove.
Ken Cosgrove is, like, my favorite character. I think he might be one of my favorite characters in the show. Do you guys have any thoughts about any of these other...
The Brit guy, Lane.
Oh yeah.
Is like the Brit who fell to Earth or who fell to America. He's clearly a fallen kind of guy. He didn't fit in his home country, and he moves to America, and then he kills himself. Like, you're talking about a guy tumbling down the stairs. Seemingly had everything in the world to be happy, and you would have expected. Imagine Don Draper is thankful for Lane in his life because Draper would have killed himself had he not seen Lane do it first.
Hmm. Yeah.
He realized, I'm not buying that product. I'm not going that way.
I mean, the English really get fucked in this series. The one guy gets his leg chopped
right
off. That whole company, like, they tangle with America and just get hosed. And then they don't come back, right? We don't, like...
Well, that brings us to Patrick's contribution. Because Patrick has his whole, you guys, you know, it's not in the kitchen sink. There's a strawberry fields. Tell us about your deal, Patrick, if you could, because holy cow.
Hold on, there's an airplane flying over my house right now and I can't hear anything.
Oh my God, that's so ironic.
I know.
as I'm telling you guys this, I'm thinking about the thing with, so I was watching Mad Men and I see 666 out the window. And I'm with Amy, and I'm like, it fucking says 666. She's like, what? And I'm like, no. And we freeze frame it. You know, I'm looking at it. I'm like, this fucking 666 out the window on this building across the way. And right after that, you know, Joan picks up a plane off of what looks like a miniature version of the Freedom Tower and throws it across the room. And what does she say?
Here's a surprise.
Here's a surprise! And it's like, you know, you're like, oh, what the fuck? She just took the plane off the anti-prism in front of the 666 fucking Sun Square building across the street. And it's like this whole weird thing. But, like, you're speaking to the English. I just want to point out that, like, Patrick has done all this work. There's, like, these enormous threads on another, what's the group called?
Strawberry Fields.
That's it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a Paul is Dead thing that, you know, Patrick has contributed to, and man, it's just, there's so much there. I don't know if you could do, you know, much of it justice here, Patrick, but oh my God.
Yeah, I don't know. There's definitely a lot of influences in that show, from, you know, Jack Kerouac to The Godfather, Kubrick. But I think there's also interweavings of, like we've kind of touched on, Babylon Working motifs and other conspiracies like moon landing and 9/11. And there certainly seems to be a lot of Beatles motifs in there, like the kind of how the way they all draw on the same influences, like Kubrick and the Beatles, and all them. They all seem to keep putting these same motifs into their work. I mean, like, even the Paul's Dead myth seems to be woven in there. Because, I mean, first of all, the legend states that he was replaced by a man named Campbell. And you've got this whole Don and Dick dynamic with Campbell. They're always, you know, competing and tangle up with each other. Yeah, I don't know. It would take a whole other show to go over all these things, but I don't know. Well, that was the first obvious one.
We've talked about the Pete and Don connection a bunch here, but do you think it's interesting how their stories wind up? Like, where, like, Pete Campbell, he definitely, you know, wins the 50s.
Yeah, he got the fairy story ending.
Yeah, he gets his wife and his kid back. He's now the executive of a plane of Lear Jets, which, remember, his dad died in a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and he gets the happy, you know, he really does get the 1950s happy ending. And Don Draper gets the 70s, right?
And Pete Campbell dies in Manhattan on 9/11/2001.
Right. Is that...
There you go, obviously.
I see, that's the show that I see.
I'm not leaving. I'm going to die here right in Manhattan. And there's a whole, like, 9/11 sync web around him during that show. You know, he never grieves for the child that he made with Peggy, who he'll never see. He's completely forgotten it, or he's stuffed it so far back in his brain that that's why he wants to get his wife and child back so much, because he knows that he's abandoned his own child. And so he thinks that he's going to be, you know, it's Lear Chat, it's King Lear, right? He goes blind. He thinks that he's successful until he slams into that fucking plane in Manhattan when he's, what, like 70? Well, right. That's just my whatever.
That's really interesting. Huh. That's the kind of conversation, that's the kind of stuff this conversation was built for.
It was built to be demolished.
Sorry. Well, you just look at where are these people going to be in 30 years? The places that we leave them, are they as pure or as happy, or are they superficial? We see Don blissed out in a Zen state, you know what I mean? And then, you know, it's assumed that he created that Coke commercial. Wiener tells us he created that Coke commercial, but there's some doubt when we first see it. And I think what that doubt does is allows you to at least examine the Coke commercial itself. You know, cocaine makes its first appearance in that last episode.
Yeah. There's
something very specific about cocaine in that episode.
I know. I mean,
Joan the Scarlet Woman, who was the whore Babylon, who allowed herself to be stuffed to become a partner in the game, right? She said that it feels like good news, right? Good news, you know, is the gospel. The gospel is the symbolic, like good news of the logos. You know, it's the Holy Spirit. So
logos, I believe.
They're in the synthetic gospel that is money and cocaine and selling Coca-Cola with these hippie politics attached to it. It's all bullshit, you know.
And then, of course, Peggy's last conversation with Don, where she says, "Don't you want to work on Coke?" Which
boom,
is like,
right?
Like, yeah, come back. It's the 70s. We're all going to work on Coke.
Right.
We're riding that train, Don.
That doesn't feel like a mistake. I mean, I had that thought. Oh. Sounds like you had that thought. I think a lot of us had that thought, because you're looking at this transition. What is one of the key markers, you know? As like, when I look at, like, a lot of culture, you know, like, especially subculture shit, you know, that's... it seems like I always ask myself, like, what the drug is. Like, with music, it's like, oh, well, what's the drug that I'm listening to? You know, like, I don't take enough fucking ketamine and GHB to get into what these kids are into nowadays with their fucking Zima and their roller skates and whatever. You know, I can't relate to it. But, like, there's something to be said for that, like, advertising goes beyond products that people literally buy in a store. Advertising is happening on all levels. I mean, that is public relations. Like, public relations is what popularized cocaine. It wasn't just cocaine working by itself. It was this whole push and this whole image and this whole everything. And how could you get people to give up such an expansive reality that they were coming out of and, like, embrace this whole ego drug, you know? I mean, I guess that's, I don't know, maybe that just comes with the nature of the thing to some degree, but it seems like that's like a huge part of what was happening there and what was being communicated. I don't know.
Is the social engineering the social engineering comment, is that saying it's a comment on the social engineering aspect of advertising, or is it a comment that says this show is socially engineering the next?
It's Jim Jones. It's drink the Kool-Aid. Drink the Coca-Cola. Hmm. Everyone fall down at once. Yeah, it's social engineering. It's redesigning the death wish, right? The death wish used to be the cigarette, you know what I mean? But they can't tell people the reason why you like this is because you want to die, right? And then people get hip to that, and then they just redesign the selling points, and they just sell the death wish right back to you. I think people get addicted to the death of the ego. They just keep killing their ego over and over, but, you know, there's no dissolution like that thing you're talking about, like... it's just, it's a holding pattern. It's, every opening of every Mad Men, he falls off the building over and over again, you know,
yep.
His shadow. It seems so explicit.
So then do we roll in Mark LeClaire and open up the Valis loop conversation?
Well, it's right there. It's the, you know, I've got a case of the Mondays. What does that mean? It's the same day over and over and over again. Hump day, you know, every day has this cliched arc.
Already said Breakfast of Champions. Now we got Goodbye Blue Monday.
Well, there's this phrase, this term that comes out of the kind of practices and teachings that were propagated at Esalen, which goes that today's breakthrough is tomorrow's ego trip.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, I think that's kind of the idea that, I mean, Don Draper, he does grow. He is not as, you know, blind to himself. He gets to know himself better over the course of the series. He just doesn't have the fake enlightened epiphany that we're supposed to get. He doesn't get to walk off in the sunset. Instead, he walks back into the office ready to kill again. You know, on it, like, he's had his breakthrough. It's going to become a cocaine fueled ego trip, and then who knows what the he's just going to, like you say, he's going to keep spiraling. He's going to keep doing what he does. And
I mean, they show that they let the wheat and the chaff grow together, you know, and then they're separated at the end. I mean, to some degree, I mean that.
Yeah,
you guys see the prodigal son in this story to the max. I mean, it's very religious. Like, even in, you know, at that certain point when he goes in the ocean, you know, when he's getting his identity, coming to terms, like, it's like this baptism. There's such this religious aspect to the whole show. I mean, you guys see that, right?
But I think that what they do really wonderfully is that, and I think that I think maybe it was Patrick who was saying this, the soap opera aspect of it. They're so deft at representing, you know, casting great characters, building great characters that are all fictional and all of their dramas are made up, and we are so engaged in them, and yet to put it in this backdrop of all the stuff that we're talking about and picking up on, whether it's, if you know about history, you're going to get more out of this show because of knowing about history. If you know about the religious architecture of, you know, of consciousness, then yeah, we're going to throw some of that in there too. And putting a tarot card at the end is explicit.
Not just a tarot card. He put the tarot card that's literally the conscious mind. So you have Raish, right? Front of the head. so opposite the moon, and so it's not subconscious. So it's as if, you know, basically it's encouraging the individual to make the unconscious conscious, so to speak. Not that you can ultimately do that. I mean, the subconscious remains the subconscious, but in terms of like understanding symbols and how they relate to the archetypes, that's the meaning of that card. Like, of all the cards in the deck, that's like, you know, come to understand, you know.
I want to throw another thing out here. I'm just looking at the IMDb, the Wikipedia page, and they're saying that as of 2003, seven of the nine writers on, no, as of it's not 2003, as of its third season, seven of the nine writers on the show were women. And part of the thing about making a TV show, like Matthew Weiner, it's his show, and he runs it, and he created the architecture of it. But he then went out, and just if he, like, just the way he cast the best actors to bring other things, you know, John Hamm kind of has to be Don Draper. I mean, he, that's that's some genius of casting, because he was, you know, he was a guy who was doing walk-ons. He, you know, he did a one line or, you know, one bit scene in Fear and Loathing of Las Vegas. In Las Vegas, he's the gay.
Oh, that's hotel. Fucking him! No way.
Yeah.
He's the, oh God, the hotel.
Yeah, guy. The guy. Yes, that's.
Oh my God, dude! That's really.
So John Hamm is walking around being that guy, and Matthew Weiner sees him, and you know, it's really interesting. He goes, you know, he's an unknown actor. He's playing the lead. In the second or third season, he's one of the producers of the show. And that's a sign of, like, he went from being nobody to being not just a star, but iconic and a star really overnight. And that's, you know, that's brilliant casting. And I guess my point that I want to say is that if you do that meticulously with your actors, you're also going to do that with your writers. And I would be very interested to know, like we're talking about all this the stuff that's built around the back of it, this the sacred architecture, the history, that the people he's hiring, he's getting people who have that expertise to fill that in with and for him, right? Because something this big can't just come out of the mind of one person. Yeah. It's someone who built that team. So I don't know. I don't have that information here, but I'd be really curious to know who was in that writer's room, who the women were, because
sure.
It's such a well-written show, and it's so smart. You got to think, you know, I know that Lynn Shelton directed an episode of it, and she's a director out of Seattle who's made a bit of a name for herself. And she's someone to keep an eye on. I don't know. These are the sinks that I'm really curious about, are like, who are the people who are creating these it's an entirely imaginary world they created.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely?
That feels because of the, well, I guess, yes, it's not a science fiction world, but it's just like if you wrote a story about a love story during the Revolutionary War.
The figure and ground of this production, the figure is entirely imaginary, the storyline. But the ground, the reason why it's successful is that, you know, you can't control the imaginary, but you can control the ground. They make every single detail of every interior shot as precise as possible. The clothing, the styles, the way the language of every room is put together is so precise that it mirrors the ground that these imaginary characters really would live in. So you have this really strict local dimension in the ground, and then you get free to fly into the non-local, into the stinky stuff with the figure. But I mean, 90% of the work of that show was the ground. Like, that achievement is so insane. It's like, we could write Mad Men, but we could not produce one 10-minute stretch of the way that thing is put together physically, stylistically, yeah. And the magic of that part of the production, I think, gets lost more than anything.
Man, when fucking Don right. Draper and Peggy finally have that night where it's like the two of them and they get all... You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
There's like the night That was the my favorite episode, just all esotericism aside, whatever, but like on its own terms, like as a good writing, like getting character development and then getting it to that point where you could actually feel, you're like, finally, they're fucking like growing out. And there's this whole thing, but like, it's interesting because I was reading recently in the Zohar with my teacher where it was explaining that the relationship between Za'er and the Shekhinah is one of brother and sister, which is like why they never actually like, I mean, in the world that is to come, yes, these two things meet, but it was expressing how the appeal of the Klipot is a whole other thing because they don't, they're it's like a brotherly sisterly love that they can't make into a relationship. Because it's like, doesn't necessarily feel right. It's kind of a weird thing to be describing in terms of that. But like, I looked at Peggy and I was like, well, if there's a Shekhinah on the show, it's her. And Don is ultimately that, but that's, but his Don is draped. He's making a beast of himself. It's like, he who makes a beast of himself rids the pain of being a man at the beginning of Fear and Loathing. You know, that's kind of convenient. I was thinking about that earlier in the conversation when this was 42 minutes, literally that line of he who makes a beast of himself rids the pain of being a man in relationship to Don Draper, relating him to the beast, hence, you know, the sun at the end of every episode. And that kind of, I'm like, this is all Babylon. The basis for Babylon is the Babylonian sun square. He's like the basis for Babylon as far as Mad Men is concerned. And so I was like, oh, but he isn't that. He's like purging himself of the clephotic layers, which is literally like his father's dick being boiled in pig fat. So like, I, you guys get where I'm kind
of
going with this?
Yeah, and I want to know the balance of that. So he who becomes a beast gets rid of the pain of being a man. What about she who becomes a scarlet woman?
Right, well, she
does she take on the pain of the world?
I think she is bringing something else to it. It's like the only, like, it's not, it's about what she's,
it's the black swan, right?
I don't think it's as simple as the thing. I think it's like both at once or something. It's like she's, you know how like in alchemy you separate, you coagulate, and you reunite? Like there's like this whole thing that's like this transmutation process that I see throughout the episodes. And like that's why I see the symbolism of moving through the whole 78 tarot deck. You know, you have 78 episodes, and then you have two sets of 7 and 7, which equals 14, which is temperance, which is fucking the peg with Samech. Samech is the peg, is Peggy, is the fucking, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's, I mean, for me, that was just immediate. I was like, 7, 7, 14, temperance, 7, 7, strength, Oz. Oz create, like, Emerald City, New York, the whole, like, it was just doon, 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 doon. As far as synchromysticism is concerned, this show is just off the fucking charts.
You do a little dance on the couch and that's like hitting your brain.
It's basically just like Risky Business. I like come into the room, I'm holding a pickle.
Yeah,
that's funny that you would say you would reference Risky Business though, because that in another way was a bit of cinema that signaled a major shift in a lot of things. And it was thematically, you know, Joel from that, the Tom Cruise character from that, is on the track to becoming Don Draper.
Oh, totally. He should have stopped there, though. Tom Cruise should have stopped the Risky Business.
Well, see, that's then kidding, you're just getting into actor hate, which is just, you know, that's...
I'm joking, I don't
love,
hate...
No, I love to have the Tom Cruise conversation, because as an actor, you put up all of his best stuff against, you know, over time. I mean, the guy's a whack job, but then that only makes me think he's more of an artist. Like, if he was as normal as Tom Hanks, like, I'll put my Tom Cruise up against Tom Hanks any day on anything but likability.
Hey, they probably put each other up against themselves.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope that's how we get beautiful things like Colin Hanks. And Mr. Penelope Hanks. Cruz.
Oh, you asked me, he was Tom Cruising for a bruising.
People should think, I mean, if you like Mad Men, think about checking out Risky Business, because it is about a guy who wants, you know,
oh,
who becomes a pimp. as a classic, you know, as a heroic 80, beginning of the 80s kind of move. And also the way that movie is shot is, you know, is, if you look at the way that other films of that time period were shot, Risky Business was actually shot a lot more like an ad than it, you know, before Ridley Scott was really getting into that kind of stuff, and or Tony Scott, before the Scott brothers and well, others.
Risky Business, that was a Coca-Cola advertisement, was it not?
Well, so this is what's interesting to me, this idea of advertising, and we need something to believe in. And so does that mean the human condition is emptiness? And then that speaks to consumption versus nourishment. And I think ending at Esalen plays with that a little bit. But then, so it's funny because Mad Men has kind of been the subtext to a lot of, as I hear various conversations, so like Alan's conversation with Jason Horsley on The Liminalist, I took some notes after that. And then when Will and Bill spoke, same thing. And like the underpinning is this idea of empire. So Will and Bill are shitting on their thrones. But the reason why they do that is because our thrones are located on the Death Star. We're at the pinnacle.
The goddamn X-Wing has crashed into the Death Star. Nothing is fucked. I'm sorry.
I just wonder about, so like, as, you know, yeah, Luke Skywalker, you know, Philip K. Dick, let's blow up the Black Iron Prison. Is that possible?
Well, if you think about, I mean, if you're talking about Esalen and you're talking about, I mean, all of these myths, whether it's, you know, Star Wars, Joseph Kane, like, when Don Draper has his awakening moment, none of that's happened. Like, think about, I mean, again, I'm just going to sink on the cruise thing again for a second. The Scientology comes out of Esalen, you know, comes out of, whether, you know, out of that soup. And
I don't know about that necessarily.
That Scientology, that L. Ron Hubbard was, I mean, that crowd of.
It's true, actually.
L. Ron Hubbard and Esalen are in bed together.
Well, yeah, the whole idea, I mean...
Because, I mean, that guy who was teaching the little session was modeled on Alan Watts, and there's pretty far distance between those two camps.
Let's be clear, Esalen is a huge hub for a lot of different people. Everybody, Al Gore went to fucking Esalen, all right? Reagan, I think, went to Esalen. It's not like, you know, it was a think tank and a movement. It's like a whole pot, you know?
So one of the things that happened or happens regularly is we'll have somebody on 42 minutes and then you only have that moment to prepare for the show, and when the moment's gone, you're done because you have to start working on the next show. And so I really regret not finishing that book by Kripal about Esalen, because there is so much in it. It's a huge book. And there's just, you know, the characters that go through that place are incredible. Burroughs, you know, just anyone interesting, Manson, all kinds of crazy stuff. And so I definitely, like, it's funny, the Crowley stuff does not interest me at all, but there's something uniquely American that was brewed up in California for some reason. Like,
so Amy and I have gone to Esalen. When we go in the middle of the night. I actually have friends that work there, which I haven't been taking advantage of, even though I probably could. But I'm not saying this just to brag. This is reality. But if you guys, have any of you ever been to Esalen?
No.
So
I was there in 1967 in my mother's womb. There's a whole story about Fritz Perls trying to get my mom and another woman to have actually have a physical fight.
Oh,
because of, you know, like, it was sort of like, it was very much out of that sort of encounter group kind of thing. Like, okay, is there a vibe here? Is there some antagonism? Well, I want you to engage that. What does that feel like? You know, that
right,
kind of
right, right. Well, that was the thing. It's like, and even in Century of the Self, when they go to Esalen, you can see when they tried to, have like a nonviolent communication between blacks and whites, but they're like, we're just going to come out and just say, you know, the stereotypes and all the bullshit and just, you know, just let it. And then it's like complete failure, total meltdown, you know. But yeah, anyways, there's like these cliffs there, man. And there's these tubs that you can hang out in these mineral tubs and watch the fucking, you're like on the ocean. Like you see, like if you go there on a full moon, man, that is the most epic fucking beautiful sight. It's nuts. And you just, there's all of these tubs and you can just sit in these tubs on a cliffside. It's the fucking coolest shit ever. But I don't know what that has to do synchronicity wise with much necessarily. But.
Well, I think it has to do with the idea that we get this idea that Esalen, because MK Ultra touches on Esalen, then everything Esalen is MK Ultra. And that's like saying, you know, because MK Ultra touched on acid, then everything acid is MK Ultra. It's like there are hubs where all this
on the cliff. What do you think of? I think of that drug Cialis, right?
Hubs on the cliff.
Wonderland. It's a boner pill. Like Esalen sells boner pills. It's a pharmaceutical new age factory.
I've never taken a boner pill, sir.
Did you take the red pill or the blue pill?
Did you take the red boner pill or the blue boner pill?
But, you know, he found his dick there with this.
Well, no, but yeah, you're speaking
down
in
the rabbit hole of a blue pill matrix. You know.
Yes, you're speaking, and that is what Mad Men is saying. But again, confusing the made up story there with the, you know,
but
with
the myth is the thing that affects me. The real place that has no connection to me, but the myth that it created is something that has had an effect on me. So I should really speak of it in terms of Mad Men more than the reality.
Right.
My favorite Esalen sync is that on November 22nd, 1963, JFK is assassinated, Aldous Huxley dies, and there's an earthquake at Esalen.
Oh, and the Beatles release Meet the Beatles, right, Patrick?
Yeah.
So wait a minute, is that on November 22nd? Because I looked that up and it seemed like it was 2 days off. Or something.
Yeah, it's on the 22nd in the UK.
In the UK, thank you, sir. But it is their first American record, which came out in America within a few days of when it came out in the UK.
Release date, January 20th, 1964.
In America. In America. How does this work?
It says 64, though.
No, it came out.
January 20th, yeah, 19th. I'm looking at the Wikipedia right now.
Right, but there's some confusion.
It released its first U.S. Beatles album to be issued on January 20th. It was in, English. They usually say release date, January 20th. Anyway, the first three tracks.
So the White Album came out on January 22nd, 5 years later, right?
Yeah.
Just trying to be clear on that. But I could have sworn. So what was the deal, Patrick?
Well, they have a song called This Boy that was released in... I saw her standing there in the United Kingdom with This Boy from the original November 1963 release. So maybe they had their first... English single released.
There was a reason why we came to that, because I saw it before too, and I'm confused as because I looked at the Wikipedia too, and the Wikipedia threw me off. But there's something happening there,
and I don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is either. Can't remember. I do know that the first episode of the first season of Doctor Who came out on that day and year, November 22nd, 1963. Which is interesting in terms of the whole time travel aspect in regards to Kennedy and tragedy things in general. You notice
and
that?
Doctor Strangelove was supposed to have its premiere for the press that day.
So Doctor Strangelove was supposed to have its premiere for the press on the day that the first episode of the first season of Doctor Who came out. So you got the Doctor Strange and Doctor Who. That's interesting.
Does anybody remember what was significant about when Don listened to the album Revolver by the Beatles?
Yeah. Patrick?
He puts on Tomorrow Never Knows at the end, right?
Right,
but there's a detail to it that's specific.
Yeah. Patrick, you got something there, don't you?
I couldn't hear what Bill said.
He was asking about when Don Draper puts the Beatles Revolver on at the end of that episode and he takes the needle off.
Yeah.
That relates to the relax and float downstream, the God is dead from Rosemary's Baby and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. How? I can't remember. Or the Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary, or what was it?
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. This is not dying.
Right, but there was something with the date. So when that...
Oh, they recorded that song, I believe, the same week that Time released their Is God Dead issue.
Right. Draper doesn't have a father. He has his entire, dilemma right there on the page. You know, he never met his father. But the weird thing about Revolver is he puts the album on, and everyone who's played the vinyl album of Revolver knows that the first song on the set where you would put the groove down is not Tomorrow Never Knows. It's the last
right.
song on side two.
Right. Oh, but, totally.
But for a guy obsessed with details, he could just simply not let us see Draper put the needle on the record, right?
Right.
But he shows you this little twist, this little warp in time. I just think that it's a very odd choice. It seems clunky, and you say, oh, that's like a Kubrick mistake. Like, it was a continuity error, right?
Sure.
They didn't catch it. No, he's in full control of his production. That thing is in there for a reason to make you think a specific way.
So
right?
What song is he really playing?
Right.
Taxman.
Really?
Taxman. That's right, because Taxman's the first song on Revolver.
Well, the first song on the second side.
No, the first... Oh!
First song on the second side, what is it?
No, the first song on the second side is probably like...
Can't remember.
Like, not good. Maybe Good Day Sunshine?
So you guys know that Revolver was originally going to be called Abracadabra, which is really interesting because Aleister Crowley changed the spelling for Abracadabra to call it Abrahadabra, which is weird because the actual spelling of Abracadabra is not Abracadabra, but Abducadabra, because Europeans mistook the Raish.
That was
the
right.
Dalit for Raish, which is that every Mad Men episode ends with the Raish, with the sun card. Which is just funny because that was the switch in Abracadabra. It's Abducadabra. It's not a race. It's a Dalit. And then the Beatles themselves changed the spelling of the word beetle, you know, to be the beat or whatever, you know. So you have the scarabs, you know, scarabs and the Rolling Stones, the Rolling Dung Balls. But I find that really kind of interesting that there's this whole correlation between the spellings. Like, there's the five Beatles, and then there's, four Beatles. There's two Pauls. But, you know,
but there was the original, was Stuart Sutcliffe?
Well, and then there was Pete Best. I mean, yeah. I mean, if you want to expand,
you wanna go
there's
there.
A lot of...
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, in terms of the symbolism of the Beatles, you have the four, you have, like, the four-letter name, you have Tetragrammaton, right? What makes Jesus, you know, Jesus is Tetragrammaton with a shin in the middle, right? So he's, like, the addition. I was just relating this whole thing of, like, why the emphasis on there being five Beatles subliminally over and over and over and over and over again, which is something I didn't realize until Patrick's page really caught my attention.
Well, the five Beatles are the Stones, right? I mean, and Don doesn't go to the Beatles. He gets his daughter Beatles tickets, but he goes to the Stones concert.
Right. That's right. I know. I had that whole... Yeah, I remember that.
And he ends up just talking to one of the girls who's into them and trying to figure out why she's into them. Like, he's like, what is it? He has this great little, advertising research moment with...
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Because he's trying to figure out his daughter, and he's also trying to figure out, you know, it's really, that's a good Don episode. You really see the workings. And by the way, Good Day Sunshine would open the second side of Revolver.
Oh,
what would you guys consider the major women that Don Draper gets involved with in the show.
Well, like, the first, there's the Bohemian girl, the Bohemian, at the beginning. She was amazing, you know. And then there's the waitress. If you just think about it in, you know, in terms of like how they're staged, there's the waitress he chases after at the end, and the Bohemian girl he's with at the beginning.
But there was his neighbor that he got all creepy.
Oh, the yeah, Catholic. That was her.
She was a Catholic. She falls in love with the Jewish business, the department store lady.
Yeah.
That's like the first one he totally falls head over heels for. It's like, I can't believe, why am I attracted to her? She isn't the, you know, stereotypical right. picture of beauty. It really throws him, and he redefines his attraction to women. He's getting in touch with something that he never had. And I think he first feels it with, what's her name, Rachel? Who dies at the end.
Yes, yeah, she dies at the end. And then the Maypole teacher, the teacher from the Maypole episode, who's...
Right?
It's now I'm thinking about Rachel and Leah. Is that the story? But we need Jason Pereira.
Oh, Rachel and Leah from the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's significant. I can't remember all the specifics around it, though I should.
I mean, that when she...
That's Fatal. There you go. You got your Eastern star. You know, Fatal around the fucking... Those are the two... Okay. In the pentagram. Are you guys not know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Never.
I just want to mention here that Patrick has put up with the Beatles, came out on November 22nd, 1963. This is their first American album, is that correct, Patrick?
It's their second UK album.
Oh, their second UK album.
The US version was retitled Meet the Beatles, but in the UK it was With the Beatles, and that's the one that was released on November 22nd.
Right, so ultimately this ended up becoming... Yes. Their first American album. It just didn't go by the same title.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same fucking album, right? Pretty much, or
yeah, I believe so.
Okay, well, there.
A couple of different tunes, I think.
Yeah, no, that makes it make all good.
So what the fuck? Seriously, November 22nd, 1963, with the Beatles. November 22nd, 5 years later, the White Album.
The year RFK dies.
Mary's Baby. What the fuck? Yeah.
1968,
White Album.
Where did I just read that?
The freaking November 22nd, you got your fucking, if you like, that's the thing. You're like, oh, what a happy coincidence that freaking their album was released November 22nd, 1963, with the Beatles, which became Meet the Beatles, which was their connection to America. So you have your British Invasion, but like, the 5th year anniversary, if that wasn't a sync wink to the fucking max with the goddamn Beatles, I don't know. Yeah. I'm just sorry.
Well, and then how much, and then, I mean, bringing it around to Mad Men, because, I mean, I guess we could probably refer to other episodes of Always Record where we've discussed Rosemary's White Album, but how much that, you know, when you listen to the White Album, laid up against Rosemary's Baby, which features, you know, actual players in these, you know, in the story that we're talking about, this history, that the part, what do you call it, the ground, Bill, the, you know, that, like, yes, Mia Farrow, yes, and Frank Sinatra and Charles Manson and Roman Polanski and the Beatles and the Maharishi and all of it is all wrapped up in both the White Album and Rosemary's Baby, and they're so inextricably linked by history that the fact that they work, you know, artistically, as David and I have gassed on a lot, is, you know, it is like a weirdly, I don't want to say happy coincidence, but
hey, it's back up,
you know,
by
an
the
amazing
way, Google Plus
synchronicity. What,
dude? You just totally connected that for me, man. Like, they share as much of the same ground, and they become actually attached as artistic works that play off of each other. That,
yeah, completely.
You know, right. Scratch your back, you scratch your mind, you know?
Yeah, you go on to scratch my dick, I'll scratch yours.
And that's what Matthew Weiner is doing when he's tossing all that Rosemary's Baby Manson stuff at us subliminally in the show.
Right, absolutely. Which is where R&B really comes from, you know? It's like, that's what R&B is Rosemary's Baby.
Now, you guys call it Rosemary's White Album. I always call it Rosemary's White Baby. Because
I call it Feast of the Immaculate Conception. But,
well, that's, you know, that's much better. But, you know, that baby that's born in Rosemary's Baby is the white baby, right? These are people who are not part of, like, they want to have a white baby, a privileged baby. They want to be part of the club. So I just really love the merger of that title. So, you know, Rosemary's White Baby is
I don't know, the Rosemary's White Album thing, it's like that, I feel like it's like a baby album that you open up and all, and it's just like pictures of Vietnam and dead, you know, Bob Kennedy dead on the, you know, on the pavement. Like, this is what her, oh, Rosemary's White Album. Oh, it seems so nice. Ah! You know, like, you look at
you're
it.
Right.
Oh, it's the all truth.
Right, like, ah!
Especially with Manson, like, at the end.
But
oh yeah, well that's
counted. This is to Andres's point about 7 of 9 of the writers being women. Do we have 7? Can we identify 7 dominant women that Draper is involved with during the show? And does each female writer represent one of those women? Did they create those characters? It'd be fascinating to see if that, like you said, to get the information of the actual people and see what other works they've done and just do the thing and see how well those connect to the 7 dominant female figures, you know?
You could do that.
It seems pretty simple. The 7 being, you know, the first 7 Sephira of the Tree of Life, you know, the corporeal kind of existence, and then there's, you know, the whole thing.
And then number nine, yeah.
I would be really curious. This is another thing to think about is, so, like, thinking about how Dawn chooses Megan over the woman who was more of his equal, the psychologist who's been trying, you know, if he had listened to her, he would have got the Coke commercial 4 years earlier, kind of thing. It's sort of like Peggy, like in a weird way, how he supports and rejects Peggy all the time. Like she's definitely, in the terms of the show, she's his great love. But in terms of what you're talking about, she never sets off his mommy meter, which makes him go mad, right? And
right.
So for every one of these dark mommies that he goes after, is there a path untaken, like a good, like a woman who was his equal, who he could have connected with, but instead went the other way, you know, like thinking of the first one of those maybe being Don Draper's real wife, Don Draper's widow, who becomes his, you know, his caretaker, the woman who gives him, who does his tarot reading. She's this bringer of wisdom, and it doesn't turn him on at all.
Mm-hmm. Turn me on, dead man. I was just thinking that, and then you said it doesn't turn him on at all. That's funny. But turn me on, dead man, being the backwards message in what is it, Patrick? Where does it say turn me on, dead man?
Evolution number 9.
Walrus.
Okay.
Number 9.
I'm the walrus. I'm the walrus.
Number 9. 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 Number 9.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com. Slow.